Butch is going to talk about listing them. He's got the paper over there that you have. We're going to talk about listing these things and how you go about doing that. But we're going to make certain observations after we've listed these things. And we found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, in parentheses, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambition, our personal or sex relationships which have been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. Now, the only thing wrong, I ate some chili that gave me a heartburn, Jim Beasley. The only thing wrong with the way Bill wrote this out is he filled it out. He wanted to give us an example of what he wanted us to do, what the program wants us to do, so he filled it out. And I looked at it, and I looked at it like this. I'm resentful at Mr. Brown because his attention to my wife, told my wife about my mistress. Brown may get my job at the office, which is all legitimate reasons to have a resentment against that man. And then what it affected, see, but by the time I got to the first person and I went all the way over here to the fourth and fifth column, I had forgotten all about Mrs. Jones. So it says to make the list, I start at the top and come straight down. I list all the people that I can think of that I'm resentful at. Then I list all the principles that I'm mad about. The Ten Commandments. The institutions that I'm angry with. The post office, Internal Revenue Service. Them damn police. Jeff knows about that. You know, they all the time got them old blue lights and pulling you over. And I resented the hell out of these people and these things. But I didn't know that until I picked up that pencil and became willing to become willing to do something about the way I thought, the resentments that I had. Butch?
Thanks, Bob. I don't believe that I would keep and carry and hold a resentment if it didn't do me some good or if I didn't think it did me some good. And I also don't believe that I could entertain a resentment if I could see the truth. Because when I took a look, all mine turned out to be based on untruths. It says there we asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, which that's my social instinct, pocketbooks, there's my material, ambitions for the future, that is my plans for the future in all three areas of my life, personal relationships, including sex, that's the way I think about sex, and the only thing that's going to make me angry and cause me to have a resentment to begin with is a perceived threat to one of those basic instincts. And I can't do this in my head. I tried. I thought I had, just as you had said. But it tells me very clearly there to put it on paper. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper, and it said we made a list, and you've already talked about the list, and I put down on my list kids. I'm a little bit resentful at my kids. One of them had been misbehaving for a few days, and it interfered with my plans for what I was doing at the time. I'm getting ahead of myself. List. Kids, the city of Maryville. And that's about all I've got on there right now. I don't know whether I'm resentful at the IRS yet or not. I haven't heard back from them. So we're going to keep looking. Said we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. Now that's my first instruction on what to do with it when I've got it. To consider it. Just consider it. Doesn't say how to look at it, just says consider it. And then it suggests that the first thing apparent might be that this world and its people were often quite wrong. And that is what I seem to come to the conclusion. It said to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived.
I love the way they put this thing together now, because he tells us right up front what we already know. We already know it was their damn fault. So he tells us right up front that that's true. It was apparent that this world and its people were often quite wrong. And they were. And he tells us that, you know, right up front, so we can go ahead and get that out of the way. But to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. It was their fault.
If it's their fault, then there's nothing I can do about it.
There ain't a thing in the world. We're powerless again if it's their fault. Old Joe out there in Arkansas says that anytime he has any kind of problem, he said, "My first prayer is, God, please let this be my fault. Please let it be my fault, because if it's my fault, I can do something about it. But if it's their fault again, I've had it." But they put that right in there, right up front, to tell us that they understood that people do harm you. They really, really do. It's not what happens to us, it's the way we react to what happens to us. Butch, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
That's quite all right.
I'll probably do it again.
That'll be okay. But with the resentment, where do they come from? Like I say, it's a perceived threat to one of my basic instincts. And why do I learn to react so poorly? I believe the line becomes blurred between what I do to people and what people do to me and what's actually happening. And I believe there's a reason for this. If I walked outside that door and a man in a three-piece blue pinstripe suit took a bat and hit me over the head, I would probably react and come back in the house. And if I went outside again and another man in a three-piece blue pinstripe suit hit me with something real hard, I would begin to resent and mistrust people wearing three-piece suits, especially if they were blue pinstripe. Now, I'm an alcoholic. Some people would conclude to not just don't go out the door. But I'm going to keep going out the door, and I'm going to keep getting hit by the guy that's dressed a certain way. And my mind is going to start associating getting hit in the head with people that wear in three-piece suits, because I don't see the truth. And this is how I learned to react wrongly, incorrectly, and poorly to the world around me. And once I begin to go down this road, things get screwed up, and it takes a pencil and a piece of paper and the fact-finding, fact-facing inventory for me to begin to straighten it out. And I'm going to continue to make some observations here, and some of them are pretty important. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? In other words, if I was looking at the truth, I might have been figuring to go out this door over here instead of worrying about being mad at people in the three-piece suit. But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, in other words, I've got to learn to feel good in the light of the truth. I can't rely on these resentments anymore. This business of resentment is infinitely grave, and that's where they put you when you're dead. We found that it is fatal, for when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. So they're already beginning to tell me that it doesn't really matter what I think of a resentment or whether I think it's justified or not. They're trying to get through to me that the resentment has the power to kill. And then the way that works is if I carry a resentment, then I'm simply giving you the power to kill me. I might as well hand you a gun. It'd be quicker for both of us. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. We had to learn to process it. I'm going to get angry because I'm a human being, but they're going to teach me how to deal with it properly. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. Now, in 1939, the word brainstorm meant rage, a sudden rage. Today, we consider it to be a bunch of people to get together and try to figure something out. But the meaning of the word then was a rage. So the slow burn, the grouch, and the rage were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. Can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. Now, as I said, the resentments have been giving me a tremendous amount of power. They have given me an excuse for my lack of education. I read that over in Freedom from Bondage, how this woman's resentment against her mother, she had fed it and fanned it and nursed it, and it had given her an excuse for her lack of education, her marital failures, and that's very much along the lines of the way I used them. Some of my big ones allowed me to do about anything I wanted to do and any way I wanted to do it and blame it on somebody else. The truth was long gone from this resentment process. What had happened in the beginning was probably a mistake or nothing at all, and I had relived it and fed it and fanned it, and what they did got to be worse and worse, and what I did got to be less and less, until it got to where I was just standing there and they did it to me. And if they had done it to you the way they did it to me, you'd drink too. So this is a tremendous amount of power that I had gotten in a world where I did not know where to find power. It says this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. This is how I learned to grant people spiritual sickness, no matter what's going on, no matter whether it seems to be justified or not. My life depends on finding an angle that I can look at it very quickly so that I can be comfortable. I'm getting some interference here. Is that coming from me, or is that up there somewhere?
Yeah, I thought it was gas.
It may be. But
no, I think that's coming from outside. I don't think that's us, is it, Charles?
No, my light's not on. I'm still got power. We'll do. I'll look at it from whatever angle I need to in order to get it straightened out. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Now, their symptoms might be the same symptoms that I've had of being restless, irritable, and discontented. They might be full of resentment, fear, and guilt, shame, and remorse too. And I obviously don't like those type of symptoms. So this is beginning to tell me that I have become everything I despised in a human being. That's why I'm restless, irritable, and discontented to begin with. And of course, that stems from being intoxicated. My value system was damaged, and I stepped outside my value system, and I did things that I didn't like about myself, so I ended up in a state of being constantly restless, irritable, and discontented. And I suspect that other people are the same way. So if I can see it in myself, I need to be able to try to begin to see it in other people. And I'm going to allow them to be sick until they find a relationship with the God of their understanding that they might get well too, if they see that they need to. We pray. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." These are specific instructions on what I'm to do and what I'm not to do. We avoid retaliation or argument. That tells me how to live my life. I avoid these things with the plague. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. And these are some of the promises that we're beginning to get out of step four, and we haven't even finished making our observations yet. Referring to our list again, now this would be column four already, and I haven't taken us through this very well because I don't have the benefit of that overhead projector, and I've just kind of been reading on, but I'll go back to it. It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. And I wrote, uh-oh, in my book. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And there I have listed my character defects, my wrongs, my harms, my mistakes, and many, many other words that are synonymous with the same thing. Where, though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. So we're already talking about some of the things that we're going to be asked to do later. So we're building the foundation. We're laying down the foundation for the whole rest of the program. This is important work, and I don't believe that we need to read it to somebody and burn it. So we've got some columns already filled out. The instructions are at the top of the sheet. In the first one, it says to list the people, institutions, or principals with whom I'm angry. And we've done that. I'm supposed to fill that column out completely before I go to the next one. And then I ask myself why I'm angry and what did they do to me to cause the anger. And that is whatever I think they did to me, I'm supposed to write down there. I'm not supposed to go ahead since I know a little bit about this. I'm just supposed to write down there what they did to me. The third column, it says on my grudge list, I set opposite each name my injuries. Was it my self-esteem, my security, my ambitions, my personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? And that's what I write that down there, to the best of my knowledge. Then in fourth column it says, putting out of mind the wrongs others have done, I resolutely looked for my own mistakes. What did I do, if anything, to set in motion trains of circumstances which in turn caused people or institutions to hurt me and eventually led to my resentment to them for doing so? After we've done this for a while, it's hard to, after you've done one and then you try to do another one, then you know things that are going to cause you to write down stuff in this that's really not going to be indicative of a first four step. But nevertheless, what I'm going to find out very quickly when I look at my review of resentments is that the first column is full of people and full of institutions that they're just people and they're just institutions. They are sometimes sick people. Sometimes they're set up to be selfish. But they really don't have anything to do with me. In other words, if you took me out of the equation and put somebody else in, these people would have treated them exactly the same way. Not only that, these people can't be changed. This is one of the things that I cannot change. Most of this is going to disappear as soon as I look at it on paper. I remember Charlie telling me that 95% of my life story doesn't have a thing to do with my alcoholism. But if that's what I insist on writing, it will probably cover up very effectively the 5% that does. And this is the 5% that does. This is the manifestations of self. I'm also going to see in column two that what they did has already been done. It's a past harm, it's history. Sometimes it's many, many years old. So that's another thing I can't change. It's just as much history as the Civil War, and it cannot be changed. Now, it has affected me quite a bit. And in most cases, all of self is affected. Sometimes it's one area is affected more than others. But that's all already happened as well. That's history. It's already happened. I've already been affected. And there is nothing on this earth I can do to change what has already happened to me. So if I look at that way, that might begin to evaporate and disappear. And what I did, again, I've already done it. Whatever I did to set it in motion or to retaliate, I've already done it, and there's nothing I can do to change it. So there's no need to whine about it or wish I could have changed it, because it cannot be changed. Now, over in column five, we're going to get into some things that we might be able to change after a while. Right, Bob?
Yep. Yep. We went back through our lives. For some reason, when we read that, we thought we had to write some sort of history about ourselves. And that's just not the way it is. We write down what we're resentful and angry and afraid of and harms done to other people today, you know. Because I wrote mine, I thought, back when I was... most all of my sentences started off back when I was drinking. And I realized that I had the problems even when I wasn't drinking. We went back through our lives. Well, why do we do that? Because that past shapes my now and my future. If I don't look at it and understand it and how it affected my past, I'll never be able to understand how it's going to affect me now and affect my future. Y'all want to take a little break?
Yeah. We can take a little break.
We can take a little break. That's us, and I guess we better start.
Okay.
Here we go. All right, here we go. Here we go. Judy just reminded me of a story I told one time, and I'm going to tell it again. It's about this drunk, and he had a dog, and the dog was pitiful. It didn't have but three legs, one eye, one ear tore off. He just beat all to hell, you know. And they was going down the alley one time, and the drunk kicked a bottle, and he picked it up, and this genie come out of it and told him, said, "I'm going to let you have a wish. You can have anything you want." And the drunk thought for a while, you know, and he said, "You know, Judy, I don't have no idea how that damn story goes." It's something about a dog, but I don't remember, I swear. About. So I'll tell you this story. I know how it goes. And it reminds me a whole lot. It reminds me a whole lot of, I've had some brain damage, you know. This reminds me of what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous when I first passed through step 4 and 5. I cleaned up my image. And I was like this old boy that his wife was hard of hearing, and I know the dog story now, I remember. Jeannie popped out and gave him a wish, you know. She said, "You can have anything you want." And he said, "Well, what I'd like to have is I'd like for my friend, my dog here, to be a show dog. I mean, a sure enough beauty, smart, like them dogs that you see on television. I mean, really a beautiful, beautiful dog." And she said, "Well, I don't know if I can do that or not. Now, that may be a bit much." She said, "Is there anything else you'd like to have?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd like to be sober. I'd like to not drink." And he said, I'd like to go to AA, but I want to tell you right quick that I ain't going to them damn meetings. And I'm not going to read your book. I ain't going to get no sponsor. And I ain't going to take no steps." And that lady, the genie, said, "Bring that dog back around here and let me look at it." And I'll tell that other story another time when I need it. I was in the grocery store when I first found out about the brain tumor. And I started to turn around, and this great old big guy was standing right behind me. And I kind of lost my balance and bumped him, you know. He said, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "Brain cancer." And he got in the other line. Where were we?
You told him the truth.
Yeah?
We've been talking about these resentments and how we can get rid of them. And we've taken quite a look at them, and we've got all the information that we're going to need for most of the rest of the program here. We've got the information for 4, information for 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. So this is valuable information that we have, and we might need to keep it in a safe, but we don't necessarily need to burn it.
No, I never did understand that. If I'm going to have this stuff in step 8 and 9, I need to keep it for a while anyway. And Bush brought out something that's real, really interesting, is a good step 4 is the foundation for steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Because we're going to be dealing with the same things in all those steps. And the best we can do, but you also have to remember that in step 10, we're going to get to practice these principles in all our affairs on a daily basis, anytime we need them. So we're going to, my opinion, and it's just my opinion, is that we do these steps to begin with to learn how to do them. And then we begin to learn how to incorporate them into our lives. How we learn to use the process that we've learned through the steps to get rid of resentments or to handle resentments. And resentments and fear are not bad things in themselves. Again, it's not what happens to us, it's the way we react to it. Joe tells the story about the guy that lives in this neighborhood where everybody's just sort of lazy and laid back and laid up on the porch, and their house needs painting, and the roof's about to fall off, the fences fell down, the grass needs cutting, and all the houses look alike. They're all like that, see. Well, this one dude comes in and buys the house, and he puts a new roof on. He paints the house, he fixes up the porch, he cuts the grass, puts the fence up and paints it. Now, everybody in the neighborhood's going to resent him. If they take that resentment and better themselves, if they take the resentment that they have against this guy and better their own place, then the resentment was a good thing. But if they do like most of us done, we'll just say, we'll just burn his damn house down. So then it's a bad thing. So it's all in how you look at it and study it and how you use resentments. All right, and now notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Ms. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our life. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances, and I believe that's the only place they mention trains in the big book. That's the only place I've ever found, which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. You know, the fear I had of the Internal Revenue Service was caused by me, because I cheated them. You know, and I had to go down there after I'd been sober a little while. They sent for me, and I went down there, and they told me they expected me to do everything in my power to not pay them any more money than I had to. And I said, even cheat, and they said, we'll catch you. And they did, you know. People told me, another one of those stories about, you know, passing the group of people and listening to people tell me what to do. They said, this is what you do. You put all that stuff in a box and just go down there and dump it on the table and tell them that's your records. And if they don't like it, they'll just have to learn to live with it. Well, I did basically that. I just went down there and dumped it on the table and said, that's it right there. And they said, well, that's not what we want. And I had to straighten it out. And then when I got through and I found out I owed them some money, I said, what do I do now? Just send you payments monthly? And they said, no, we prefer you go ahead and pay us today. See, those people had the right idea that I'd tell them and get away with these. It didn't work. It didn't work. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we asked ourselves why we had them. Why do I have this fear? Wasn't it because self-reliance was insufficient? Self-reliance failed us. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us have had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. And when it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us, and humbly rely on Him as He enable us to match calamity with serenity. He took that fear. He took that fear. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. And all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be, and at once we commence to outgrow fear.
What a promise.
What a promise. To get rid of the fear, to ask God to take it, and at once begin to outgrow fear. Now, again, like resentment, I didn't think I had any great fears. I didn't, you know, I thought I might can come up with one or two, till I sat down and started writing them, and I found out that I was basically afraid of everything. I was afraid to run and afraid to stand still. And I didn't know what to do. I had no power to overcome that fear until I realized, just like the book says, that self-reliance failed. And the power of God would and could remove the fear if I asked him to. All right, and once we commence to outgrow fear is another promise. Bush, you want to talk about fear a little?
Yeah. Fear is also a God-given feeling, and there is a good purpose for it. And it's always helped me to hear Charlie talk about those reasons that we were given fear. It's to protect us. And we take fear, and unbeknownst to us, we go in a direction with it, sometimes using it for false power, and it becomes such a lie that we really can't even identify it. But in the beginning, we were given some natural fears, such as the fear of dark, so that we won't run into things. We can't see in the dark. We're not like some animals who can see in the dark. We're given a little bit of a natural fear of heights, so that we won't get too close to the edge and fall off of high buildings, or that we won't think that we can just simply jump and fly because we don't have wings and we can't fly. And we're given these basic fears to protect us. Now, I have used fear to excuse most of my behavior. I have used my fear of, well, what I thought was fears, but it turned out to be truly a fear of work, Bob,
and truth.
But I just got to the point where I could not see the truth, and it was based on self-centered fear. And I have used these things wrongly for so long that I believe them. And if I believe something long enough, it becomes my reality. So there's really not as much to talk about when it comes to fear as there is resentment, because all of the directions that I'm given are right here. It says we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. And then it asks me to ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And at once we commence to outgrow fear. So that tells me that the only way that I can get rid of fear is to do what I know I'm supposed to do, and it will disappear. It will go away. Red says that if I pray for courage and don't get up out of this chair, I'm not going to feel any different. I'm still going to probably be fearful. But if I will, based on a suspicion that things will work out, if I get up and do what it is I'm asking for the courage to do, then I'll be given the courage on an as-needed basis. Can you think of anything else?
Well, just a little example of courage in my own life. 10 years ago, like I said, I generally throw a shoe about every 10 years. I had to have a colostomy. And have I already told that story?
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had. It sounded so familiar. You know, just get up and get in the car. And all you have to do is practice in courage. Just make the first, that first move.
You didn't tell that part, and I think that'd make a good story about the fact that you knew that you wasn't going to go.
Yeah, I had no intentions of going.
To the hospital.
To the hospital down there, because they put me to sleep again. I wasn't going to wake up.
Fear.
And I knew it, and it was an unfounded fear. I had no reason to believe that, but I knew that was true. And I couldn't, it scared me to even go by the hospital on the railroad track behind the hospital. I'd try to be thinking of something different when I went that way. so I wouldn't have to have that fear. But anyway, I told my wife, I said, I just ain't going. And she said, but you have to. They're expecting you. I said, well, they just expect all they want to. I ain't going. I'm scared to death. I ain't going. She said, Bob, can you get in the car tomorrow morning? Can you just get up and get in the car? And I said, yeah, hell, I can do that. She said, well, you get up and get in the car, and we'll go down to the hospital, and I'll park, and then we'll see about getting out. But we'll take this just one step at a time. Say, just get in the car. And we'll go. And I went down there, and I'll go ahead and tell this because I remember it's a true story. And again, not all my stories are true, but this one is. I went in that hospital room with the idea. I knew enough nurses down there that I could get some drugs. You know, and I thought, well, I'll just drug out and, go on down there in the morning in a blank state of mind. And if I make it through, I'll make it. If I don't, I won't even know it. And this nurse come in, this LPN came in, and she was from Columbia, South Carolina, South America. And she says to me, what does it mean when it says the Lord is my shepherd? And I tried to explain to that girl what I thought it meant. And I don't know if it made any sense to her. I don't know if it made any sense to me. But I do know when she left that room, I had such a sense of peace that the surgery the next day didn't bother me in the least. And I went down in the operating room, and me and two of the nurses held hands and said the serenity prayer. The doctor come in and said, give out the chips, the meeting's over, we got work to do. Now, Joe and Charlie always like to have sex on Sunday morning, but they're older than me and Bush. And we like sex in the afternoon. So we're going to talk about sex on Saturday afternoon. And we don't need to cringe or be fearful of what we're going to say about sex, because if we look at this thing the way it is in the book, there's nothing dirty about it. There's nothing to snigger about. It's just a natural human thing. I did a fifth step with a girl one time, and she asked her sponsor, and I asked my sponsor, and I asked my wife, could I do it? And we went right on through step five and the sex part, and it didn't bother her and it didn't bother me. So there's nothing to be ashamed of or afraid of talking about sex in Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It is so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the other voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of our troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school, but I love the way they write this too. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Question mark. Ponder. We want to stay out of this controversy. Alcoholics Anonymous wants to stay out of the controversy of sex. They don't want to be telling you how to conduct your sex life. They don't want to do that. And if the program itself doesn't want to tell me how to stay out of people's sex lives, I believe me as a sponsor, I need to stay out of their sex lives. Those guys call me and ask me, oh, what about this and what about that? And I said, let's go to page 69. Go see what Alcoholics Anonymous says about that. Well, it don't say nothing about that. Yes, it does. It covers it all. if you think it's going to harm somebody else, or it's going to harm you, or it's going to make you restless, irritable, and discontented, what does it tell us to do? Don't do that. You know, like that old doctor on Hee Haw, if y'all ever stoop so low as to watch Hee Haw, you know, they'd come in and say, "Doc, it hurts when I do this." He'd take that chicken and hit him and say, "Don't do that. If it's going to make you restless, irritable, and discontented, then don't do that. If it's going to harm another human being, don't do that. Just don't do that."
But the trouble is, we don't know what harms us. We don't know what causes that pain. And if you're like me, and this is where I had some of the worst, my worst troubles, is the way I thought about sex and what I had demanded that sex do for me. And I called my sponsor, who was this man right here, and tried to get him involved in this, and he just would not get involved in this. I knew he was a wise man, and I thought he could give me some definite and valuable suggestions, but he just wouldn't do it. He'd give me some kind of line like, "Invite God as you understand God into your relationship." And I, you know, "Thanks, Bob, I need some help here." He'd say, "Well, don't ask me, buddy." He said, "Me and Miss Judy have been married 30-some-odd years." You know, so I don't know about stuff like that. And he kept doing that, and this very quickly led to me understanding that I was at a turning point, and that where I had been demanding my power, it was no longer available, and the woman that I had chosen to make my higher power would not cooperate, and I was going to have to either drink, die, or do the steps. And I've made a little attempt. He taught me one time, he said, "Anything's worth doing is worth doing any way you can do it." That's not what Grandpa said. But my life depended on it, and anything worth doing was worth doing any way I could get it done. And it was enough to get me to involved in this book and beginning to do some of the things that I needed to do. And this sex thing, I didn't have any, what you call, social fears about sex. I was pretty open and wild, and I'd be more than happy to tell you anything I thought I knew about it. But I had a lot of hidden fears, because I had no idea about the true meaning of sex or the reasons that we were given sex. And let's face it, I was taught about sex by some people that really didn't know a whole lot about it, because they were maybe taught about sex by people that were too busy farming and gathering wood and getting stuff in, and they might not have known what they needed to know about this. So now Alcoholics Anonymous is going to give me a way that I can shape my own ideal for a proper sex life, and that I won't demand that it give me more than it's designed to do. And therefore, I won't be living my life based on unsatisfied demands. And Joe and Charlie like to say that this is, of course, their opinion, and I happen to agree with it, that God gave sex powers for two reasons. One of the reasons is, of course, to procreate, to breed, make babies, and populate His earth. And I believe that we probably wouldn't do this if it weren't enjoyable, because there's quite a bit of work involved in it sometimes. And if it weren't absolutely enjoyable, God knew that we probably wouldn't do it, and the earth would not be populated. So that tells me that sex was given to me for two reasons: either to make children, which I have done and I'm very grateful for them, or for enjoyment. And I used to think that when I wasn't making babies, I was doing it for enjoyment. But after I did my fourth step and took a look at the truth about the nature of my sex life, I could see that very little of the sex that I had was for enjoyment. It was for my self-esteem. It was to fill up holes where I thought there was nothing. It was for a place to live, and that's one of the things that I found out in my fifth step. I'd go and I'd say, "Now, this was the reason I was having sex here," and he'd say, "No, I believe you're having sex there for a place to live." So I got to a lot of truth about why I was using these things, and I could see that that was not the proper place to get my power. So I was not able to change overnight, because I still had these tapes and these obsessions going on. But I was able to begin to shape a sane ideal for my sex life based on the parameters that they give us here. They teach me how to see whether it's selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, where beforehand the only thing inconsiderate about my sex life
was if my partner would not have sex when I wanted it, how I wanted it, and as much as I wanted it. That was all I knew about inconsiderate behavior. But I realized that I had been very selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, and I had hurt a lot of people. I had hurt a lot more people than the people with whom I'd had relations. I had the potential to hurt a lot of people. If I had had sex with someone who was married, I had the potential not only to hurt their family, her family, but I had the potential to hurt my family as well. If we were found out and the marriages broke up and everything like that, there was a lot of things there that could cause me to be restless, irritable, and discontented that I didn't even know about. So this is a tremendous load that I can further get rid of just by looking at it in the light of the truth. Because when I know better, I can do better. So I wrote down on my list the people that I had harmed with my sexual attitudes, my sexual behavior, and the way I thought about sex. And then, I'm on the wrong page. I wrote down which part of self caused me to do what I did. Was it caused by the social instinct, the security instinct, or the sex instinct? And I found out there that, of course, it was mostly everything but the sex instinct. And over in column 5, which is what we're going to do on step 5, is where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, or inconsiderate. And what I learned throughout the entire process is that this is ultimately all I can change, is my reaction to these wrongs, to these lies. I cannot stay resentful based on the truth. I cannot stay frightened based on the truth. And I cannot continue to harm people sexually based on the truth. And if I have, if I believe that I can be brought around to truth or power or a spiritual experience, I believe these things are synonymous, then this is how I begin to do what God wants me to do, is to understand what's wrong with it. I cannot solve any problem on this earth without first identifying the problem. And I have behavior problems that stem from an inability to see the truth, and I cannot correct them until I've identified them. And that's the way we're given this information, to put it down so that we can look at it. And you want to talk first, or you want me to read?
Now let me talk a little first. I believe in my neighborhood now, where I learned about sex, is we had a 4,000-year-old little boy moved into our neighborhood, and he come around and taught all of us all about sex. He told us how you were supposed to do it, how often you were supposed to do it, who you were supposed to do it with. And none of us we didn't know anything about it, see. But he was 4,000 years old, and he come there to, and I believe he's in every neighborhood that you go in. They got him everywhere. But this is a true story now about sex. I knew when I was having problems, and I mostly in the thinking, you know, not so much the action, but it was in the thinking that was just about to precede the action, because I was fixing to do it, is what I was fixing to do. And I was at Jekyll Island one night, and the moon was full, and I was walking on the beach, and I had this rock, and I told God, and I talked to God this way. This is the way I communicate with Him. I said, God, I don't know what's going on with me right now in this sex thing, but I know what I need to do is I'm going to put all the thoughts that I ever had or have on sex in this rock, and I'm going to throw it in your ocean. You clean that rock up and those thoughts up, and you let me have back what you want me to have. And I walked on down the beach, and there was two little girls out there I hadn't noticed. This is swear to God true story. They took their toe and wrote in the sand, "Call us at room 227 at the Buccaneer, we're horny." I just throwed the rock in the ocean. So. And I said, God, you've got to have the damnedest sense of humor. I've been going up down this beach for 30 years trying to find these two women, and the one time that I turn it over to you, you just throw them right out there. I didn't do anything about it. But the next morning I got up and I walked out on the beach, and you could still see fade, you know, but it was still there. So I went back to the room and I called. And I told them, you know, I said, your message is still on the beach. What message? We didn't write no message. You crazy. Click. And I got my coffee and went out there on the dock thing, you know, and here they come. They're out there and they stand around and they scratch around in that spot, you know, to get that message off of the beach. But see, they probably had sex problems too. They didn't mean that. I don't believe if I'd have went up there, they'd opened the door. I think it was just something they did on a whim, you know, surely. But go ahead and read a little bit, Butch. I'll interrupt you again.
Well, that's all right. Yeah, we've got to find out what's right for us, because if we believe what they want us to believe, we're always going to be inadequate, I believe. I'm never going to be able to live up to society's idea for my sex life, because advertising has got it way out of whack.
Oh, yeah.
Says, in this way we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. We're never to make amends to get us off the hook if we're going to hurt somebody by doing so. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it.
This old boy was getting sober in AA, and he was working his steps just like his sponsor told him to, you know. And he was working on step 9, and he was out walking on the street one day, and he saw this guy and his buddy coming down. So he went up to him and he said, I got to tell you something. He said, I'm getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to make amends for the wrong that I've done to people. And he said, I just want to tell you that I've been sleeping with your wife for a long time, and I'm sorry about that. And he said, but I'm sober now, and I ain't going to do that no more. And then he just walked off, you know. And the guy looked at his buddy and said, what about him? Sleeping with my wife all this time and got sober, she ain't good enough for him.
God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice.
We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. As a sponsor or your sponsor, have they ever given you any hysterical thinking or advice? I don't think I've ever been as mad in AA as I was. I went to a meeting at Elizabeth one night, and this little girl had taken her chip, her first year chip, and she was just heartbroken, crying. And I said, you're supposed to be happy. You've been sober for a year. Why are you crying? And she said, because I'm about to go crazy. And I said, why are you about to? She said, I haven't had relationships with a man for over a year. My sponsor won't let me. I said, what in the hell does your sponsor have to do with that? And then realizing that it wasn't none of my business, I shut up. But then I went to a meeting and chaired a meeting on, you know, what we tell people about sex and what the book tells us. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. We've got a plan. We've got a process. We run this through.
We share our experience so that other people can hopefully shape their own ideas about a sex life. I have had some liberal thinking, I thought, about sex, but I know that some people are just as devastated and affected about situations that are not nearly as seemingly worldly or liberal. So we just cannot make rules in that area. I know that some of the things that work for me certainly won't work for other people. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? And I can promise you that does not mean we're going to get drunk, because I have fallen short and I have stumbled. Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, We are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience.
Butch said a minute ago that I wouldn't tell him what to do in this area. I'm not going to change doing what you tell me to do, okay? Unless I can some way agree that you're telling me the right thing and I agree with what you're saying is right. I'm not going to change just by just doing things that you tell me to do. I'm going to change by subjecting each relationship to this test. Is it selfish or not? And asking God to mold my ideals and help us to live up to them. That's how I'm going to change. I'm not going to change by doing what you tell me to do. All right?
Teach me how to figure it out for myself.
Yes. A program of self.
To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. Now, these little prayers are scattered all throughout here. They're usually one-liners or two-liners, and they're the simple prayers that I still try to use on a daily basis. There's nothing that I've been able to come up with that's any better. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed, for the truth, our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision,
step three,
and an inventory,
step four,
of your growth or handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And the truth will allow me to get rid of the fixed ideas I have about resentments, fears, and the harms I've done to other people. Now, we've been given another list by Joe and Charlie that follows up in the area of harms done to others. It's just kind of a catch-all, because they know that we alcoholics generally tend to be seeking power in the area of our sex life, and that's how we generally hurt people, or that's how I did. But here's a page that is designed to catch anything that we might not have listed on these other three pages. Like if it hadn't been covered in the resentment list indirectly, we can write down any of the harms that, other than sexual, that we had participated in, and put it through the very same set of parameters, said we treat sex as we would any other problem. So we treat any other problem the same way. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter, and the right answer will come if we want it. We're now dealing with that, the God of our understanding who dwells deep within, and Charlie talks about it being that little voice that we've always had to listen to sometimes that said, "Now, Butch, you know we ought not do this." And most of the time I would, based on my past wrong experience, would say, "Well, it feels pretty good and I'm going to do it anyway." And then I'd end up restless, sick, drunk, and all kinds of trouble having hurt someone. And that voice would say, "Butch, I told you we shouldn't have done that." And so now I'm learning to listen to that little voice the first time so I won't have to go back. And that is what this does. Now, we talked about how we had asked for direction. And this direction, I believe, is as much here for us as it is for these flowers and trees and the animals out there that are being directed by God. I believe the directions are in the air that we breathe. They're in every fiber of our body. They are simply there. But I cannot hear them or see them because I have blocked myself off by these things we've been talking about. And I just want to use one little example to help me understand how that works. I've asked to be God-directed. And Yet I have a resentment against a man that's about 10 years old. He's borrowed $50, if you really want to know the truth about it. But he didn't pay me back, so now he's stolen that $50. See, resentments have a way of distorting the truth. And I got so mad about that and stayed so mad about that and drank about that so that I went and cut the tires off of his pickup truck. And now I'm scared to death about what he's going to do if he finds out who did that, because he's a mean fella from up in Rudd Holler up in Townsend. And if I'm not a complete sociopath, I've got a little bit of guilt associated with the wrong that I did to him, because I know it's a little bit out of balance there. So here's one man who is directing all of that thinking through resentment, fear, and guilt. And if I multiply that by all the resentments that I built, I'm letting the people out there direct my thinking, not the God of my understanding. And my little computer back here has only got so many gigabytes or megabytes or whatever bytes it is, and it just doesn't have room for the directions that I need from the God of my understanding and the directions that I'm giving people the power to direct me through resentment, fear, and guilt. So all I've got to do is get rid of the things that are blocking, and I will intuitively begin to live my life the way I've been supposed to do it. I will be able to forgive you and love you the way I'm supposed to. I will be able to begin to like myself, because I'll no longer be that person that I despise. And then my relationship with God will begin to improve. And you'll notice that they said that we've simply made just another beginning. And that's all I do, is make one more beginning. Bob?
I was thinking, my computer has got flea bites, you know. Yeah, flea bites. I've got a little computer, you know, and I spent most of my life trying to run problems through it that it couldn't handle, and I didn't know it couldn't handle them, but I kept running them through there, you know, and it'd say, it'd click and carry on, and it'd say, does not compute. We don't have this information, you know. Well, step three in this program is asking me to unplug that little computer and plug it into the Big Apple, to the main computer. And the main computer has the answers. And then when I have the answers, I can plug up my own little computer again and take the answers that I got from God and use them in my own life. Now, I think somewhere along the line, and I think it started right here, if you've already made a decision, step three, in an inventory of your grosser handicaps. Now, in 1939, I'm told that the word grosser simply meant larger or the bigger part of, grosser, gross. But, you know, slang expression now, grosser means dirty, rotten, filthy things. And somewhere along the way, we got the idea that that's what step four was, a list of all the dirty, rotten, filthy things we could come up with. And my dog's bigger than your dog, so if you had dirty, rotten, filthy things, I had to try to top you. And it wasn't that at all. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for resentment, fear, harms done to other people, which causes me to be full of guilt, shame, and remorse. And I know tonight, this afternoon, that I can't lose weight hungry. I've tried to lose weight all my life, and then all of a sudden this happens. But anyway, I've tried to lose weight, and I found out that I cannot lose weight hungry. I just can't do it. And I can't get sober full of guilt, shame, and remorse. That has to go. That has to go. A spiritual awakening to me today means simply that I found a way through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous to feel good about me and to feel good about you and my brothers and sisters. And if I feel good about me and I feel good about my brothers and sisters, then my relationship, as I understand God, is just exactly the way it's always supposed to have been. I don't need to make no big to-do out of my relationship with God. God understands me. All right? We're not going to go into action because we don't use all of the charts and everything that they use. So we're a little ahead of schedule. And we're just going to kind of, I notice everybody, and I know mine is, getting a little sore. from sitting, and I've got a cushion. So if it's all right with y'all, we'll just meet again in the morning and continue it. But we'll knock it off right now so we don't wear everybody out. But I have to tell you that we lost half of our audience from yesterday to today. We don't want to do that tomorrow. See, we want to be kind and considerate and tolerant.
Thank you for being here.